Hello and welcome to Backflips and Nerds, the baseball podcast with a British twist. I'm your host, John McGee. It's a packed show this week. We've got not one, but two special guests, so I'll just get on with the pleasantries and get them out of the way. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter at @Batflips_nerds, on Facebook, facebook.com/Batflips and Nerds, and at batflipsandnerds.com. We're on all the big podcast platforms, iTunes, Stitcher, and all the rest. And if you fancy giving us a 5-star review, that'd be really flipping nice. A quick reminder, just at the top, that we'll be announcing the venue for our meetup at the Keep Your Ears Peeled. I'm delighted this evening that we are joined in the virtual studio by our special guests. From off of The Guardian and ESPN and many, many other places, it's Nick Miller. How are you, Nick?
Hello, I'm all right. How are you?
I'm not too bad. This is a bit different from Football Weekly, is it not?
Well, Barry Glendinning's not involved, so, you know, I don't know. If you take that as a positive or a negative, that's really up to you.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, we're not joined by our own Barry Glendinning, who's had to cry off because he's got to get his car fixed or something. Mr. Pringle's not with us this evening. I guess he's our resident misanthrope, as such as we have one. So, sadly, we're terrible puns or slightly annoying asides about Sunderland. Neither of those.
Well, anyway, right. So,
go on.
If you want me to chip in with some of those, I'm more than happy to.
Yeah, definitely give us the puns, and if you want to give us some Sunderland stuff, well, I won't say no, but I can't really speak for our listenership. So we're going to talk to you, Nick, about a piece that you wrote for The Guardian a couple of weeks ago about MLB's efforts to find a British identity. We're going to do that a little bit later on, so we'll come to that in a bit. But we've got another guest before that. But before I introduce the interview with that guest, which I recorded a little bit earlier on today, back from hibernation, sadly not killed by an elephant stampede, it's the least popular MLB UK office, Ben Three-Week Holes Carter. How was the trip, Ben?
It was terrific. I am refreshed and rejuvenated and the most hated man in the office, so it's all pointing up for me.
Yeah, it can only get better from the absolute nadir that you found yourself in going on holiday during the biggest baseball event in British history.
Yeah, good work, Ben. I couldn't find it any better, could I? Which is a shame to miss, but I'm sure you'll agree that if you're going to miss it for any reason, being in South Africa isn't a bad one.
Well, yeah. Did you find any baseball in South Africa? Did you get that exclusive interview with Gift and Gope's mum?
I did not, no. I can't say I tried particularly hard to search her out, but she didn't present herself to me. I did have a conversation with one particularly effusive taxi driver who told me all about his baseball experiences when he was in America. But it was a lot more of him talking than me. So I can't say it was my best baseball experience, but a little bit of baseball in South Africa at least.
So we're gonna get on with talking a bit about the week in baseball and a bit about baseball's efforts to try and find roots in the UK in a bit. But before we get on to that, we're going to answer a lot of your questions, of course. We've had some really good ones this week, including some very strange and very niche ones, especially for Nick, which we're going to make sure that we pin him down on. But before we get to that, we've got another special treat. As I mentioned, I recorded another interview a little bit earlier on today. That interview is with Evan October, who is the frontman of the Isotopes Punk Rock Baseball Club. Yes, that's right. It's a punk rock themed punk rock baseball band. That hasn't quite come out right. Anyway, it's a band that plays punk rock, that sings songs about baseball, about George Brett and so on. And they're playing in the UK very soon, supporting the legendary CJ Ramone. I'm so here, without further ado, after a little taster of the music, is my interview with Evan October. I'm delighted to be joined by the frontman of the Isotopes, or to give them their full title, the Isotopes Punk Rock Baseball Club, Evan October. How are you, Evan?
I'm doing great, John. How are you doing?
I'm not too bad, thanks. I can see that you're there in Vancouver, British Columbia, and you've got the baseball on in the background already at 11 o'clock in the morning for you.
Yeah, we're lucky we get it during the day here, and it's always on when you wake up on the West Coast, so that's nice.
Yeah, not too bad. It's rather a different story for us. It's 3 o'clock mornings, 4 o'clock mornings, even later if you're unlucky.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a big thing over here, even in Canada. So it's nice to have. And I got MLB TV, so I can watch whatever games I want usually.
Yeah. Same for us, but it's a rather more antisocial. And you're going to get a taste of how antisocial the hours are for watching baseball in a couple of months. So we can come on to that and talk a little bit about why you're here on a British baseball podcast. Of course, I don't think this isn't your first baseball podcast. I know you were on The Ringer, I think, with Ben Lindbergh and Michael Bauman a couple of months ago.
That's correct. I was on that show.
Yeah.
Not my first baseball podcast for sure, but I always like doing them, and it's really interesting to learn of this one over in the UK, because honestly, heading over on this tour that we're about to do, it was looking a little bit, we didn't know what to expect, and we still don't, but it's nice to at least find some like-minded individuals to connect with over there.
Yeah, well, we're coming out of the woodwork. I don't know if it's made it as far as Vancouver, but we had an event that the UK office of the MLB organized a couple of weeks ago, which they I don't know if it's ill-advisedly, they did it on the 4th of July, that famous day in the American and British calendar, Independence Day. They had a big celebration of American culture, a big MLB event in Hyde Park in London. So, they're getting there, but they're taking the time.
How did that go? Did you participate or...
Yeah, we were there. Yeah, we were there. It was fun. It was a bit of a weird event. So it was like a home run derby with a twist. So they had these weird targets in midair that they had Cliff Floyd and Sean Green there trying to hit these targets and hit some out of the park that was basically just made of weird fences that people kept running into. So it was, in many respects, it was fun, but it was also quite dangerous. But yeah, so people are learning about baseball. We'll see. It'll be good to know how many people have an affinity with it once they've heard you guys. So, right, coming on to the point in question, you released your latest album, 19 Champions, a baseball reference immediately, a couple of months ago, and you are set to embark on a huge tour of the UK and Ireland in August and September, supporting CJ Ramone. So it's a pretty exciting time for you guys.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a great opportunity for us, and we've never done the UK before, so it's going to be our first time there, and it's a chance to test out the waters with a fairly prominent artist in our genre. So it's a real good opportunity for us, and we're looking forward to it.
Yeah, that must be a bit of a thrill for you guys to play with someone of that stature. A guy who, although not an original Ramon, played with the band for a long, long time.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. It's an honor. And we've actually played with CJ before, once in London, Ontario. So that was about a year ago. So we're doing two CJ Ramone shows back to back in 2 years, both in London, but different London. So I think we might be the only band to have that distinction as well going for us going into this.
Yeah, definitely. And as I mentioned at the top, your full title as a band is the Isotopes Punk Rock Baseball Club. So for those who haven't heard the band and haven't lived through the live experience, what can they expect if they come along to one of your shows or they go away and listen to one of your records, having listened to this interview?
Well, I think first and foremost, we're like a good rock and roll band, and we don't, there's obviously this whole gimmick baseball thing that we do, and all our songs are about baseball, and we're all baseball fans. But, at the end of the day, you still have to be a good band if you want to have success and give people something to take home with them. So, I mean, we've been fortunate enough to get a lot of opportunity to hone our chops and become a good live band. So you're going to come out and you're going to see, obviously, that you're there to see CJ. But for a support band, we're going to come out and give him a run for his money as well. And that's what it's always about, friendly competition between bands, too. So. We're a punk rock band and we have a lot of fun doing it. So if you're into baseball, if you're into pop punk or punk rock, then I think you'll have a good time.
I think I've read a couple of interviews with you that you've done in the past, and as I said, you were on the Ringer MLB show, and one thing that stuck with me in terms of describing your demographic, you said it's Green Day fans in new era caps, and we've certainly got quite a few of those in the UK, but I think you'll find that the new era cap is unfortunately more of a fashion accessory than a statement of fandom. So I don't know what you've got to sort of win them round, those guys who might be in the crowd in that demographic.
Well, yeah, you never know. You never know what you're going to get. We get a lot of the same thing over here. So a new era cap, yeah, to go to that doesn't necessarily mean a guy's a baseball fan, but it at least is a conversation starter at the very least. And as I said, like, a lot of our fans aren't baseball fans too. Like, it's not just exclusive to that. So we don't necessarily need to convert people to the church of baseball. We just need to give them a good rock and roll show. And if people happen to be baseball fans too, then that's just the added bonus. We've played a lot. We played 7 countries this year and 10 countries last year. And a lot of places where baseball is not a preferred sport or even really, you know, acknowledged in the realm of sports. A lot of places like, you know, Spain and France, they don't really, they're not big baseball towns, as no. I've said.
You played in Italy and in Germany last year, over the last sort of 12 months or so, right? And they are sort of quite big on baseball. They're one of the bigger participatory sports in those countries, right? So did you get a few people coming up to you and, you know, chatting to you about George Brett and Jose Canseco and some of the guys who you mentioned in your songs?
Yeah, absolutely. Italy in particular was a lot of fun for us to go down there and see that, because it is, like you said, it is kind of one of the more baseball friendly countries in the UK or in Europe. And it was cool to gain that perspective from another part of the world. Germany, you know, Germany, there's a really cool, like, underground sort of non-professional baseball system. Mm. There's a lot, every city has a team, but we didn't really get to meet too many baseball affiliated people in Germany. But Germany is always great for punk shows, so we had a lot of fun there too.
Yeah, it definitely is. It definitely is, and good that there were some baseball people turning up. Their league down there is pretty good. They've got Mark Tehan playing there this year, the ex Oakland A and Kansas City Royal. I think he's 38, and I think he's there more for the wine than the baseball. But he's there in Junior Guerra, who's the Milwaukee Brewers.
The tell you that.
Sorry?
He's not there for the toilets, I'll tell you that.
Oh, he certainly isn't there for the toilets. Yeah, I've been to Italy many times myself, and that's not a lot of fun. So I mentioned there you've got a lot of songs about baseball players, unsurprisingly, and George Brett and Jose Canseco certainly feature on the most recent album, and Ray Ordonez, you've got a famous song about him. So a question for you is, how do you choose which baseball players get the isotopes treatment? Do they just sort of pop into your head, or are you thinking, I want to write a song about, you know, a nutter like Jose Canseco?
Well, no, it's not that calculated. It's kind of like, I'm a student of baseball through the 90s primarily, you know, like that's when I was growing up, and that's when I was influenced as a kid by all these new, you know, players and characters on television that you get to watch every day. And Jose Canseco just obviously is a guy that you grew up. I mean, you can't avoid, that guy can't avoid controversy and drama. So it is natural for us to gravitate toward his stories. And when it comes to songwriting about players and stuff, I'm just always, you know, looking out for interesting stories that you can turn into a song, because not everything is a song, right? So you kind of have to be selective with what people might find interesting and entertaining. The George Brett story is wildly entertaining, and I've shared it with a number of people who have no interest in baseball at all, and they still find it funny. So it's all about finding those characters within baseball that have relatable stories. And as far as Ray Ordonez, that was a guy that I grew up watching and modeling my own playing after. He's such a creative shortstop defensively that he was a huge influence on me as a player, and still is. So yeah, it's just about things that kind of touch me personally. And if I can translate, you know, that in a way to a way that people will respond to, then that's what we try to do.
So is there anyone who you would like to have written a song about that you haven't yet had an opportunity to do so, or you haven't found a way to sort of get that idea down on the page in notes and words?
I was always kind of kicking around like a Jeter song that would have been like the sister ship to the Ordonez song, because I'm not a huge fan, and at the time you had two of these great shortstops in New York, and Jeter was the one who got all the press, but Ordóñez was far and away a better defensive shortstop, but no one really had heard of him even at the time. So I kind of had this idea of writing two songs that went hand in hand, but I've never gotten around to doing that. Now that Jeter's gone, it really isn't a priority for me.
Yeah, nor should it be. I share your position on Jeter. I'm a Red Sox fan who lived through that 99 through 2003 hell. I've got no time for him. So I'm glad I'm not going to be hearing that song in a month, just over a month's time. Thanks. I was going to pitch something to you. See where you are on this. How about writing a song about a British baseball player?
Well, I was going to ask you, how many are there, or are there any at all?
There are a few. So there are none in the majors at the moment, not even who were born in the UK and emigrated. And we kind of claim them. So we had a team in the World Baseball Classic in September, a large number of whom were from the Bahamas. So that was, until relatively recently, a British sovereign territory, much as Canada and the States were back in the day. So Bahamians by rote of their grandparents, and there's a few of those kicking around in the minors who were doing all right. There's a guy who's probably the best one who might have the most chance of making the majors is a guy in the Mets system, a pitcher called PJ Conlon, who was born in Belfast in Northern Ireland. So you can mention him at your Belfast show. His parents were born and bred Irish, and they left during the difficult times in the 80s and early 90s. So he was born in Belfast, but only lived there until he was 2 years old and grew up in San Diego. So he is the best current player. Historically, the most famous British player is Bobby Thompson of Short Heard Round the World, born in Glasgow, which people don't realize. But there aren't many of them. There haven't been many at all. The one I was going to pitch to you and see how you feel about this is the last British man to hit a home run in the majors was a man who hit one home run in his entire career. He had seven at-bats for the Houston Astros in 1969, a gentleman called Keith Lampard. So if you can write a song about Keith, who's a big favorite of ours on the podcast for obvious reasons, we'll be very happy to hear it. You've got a month.
I'm going to write that down and I'll see what I can come up with for you. I don't imagine that the demographic for a song about that guy is too large. So I will... But I'll do my best.
Well, he's from the northwest of England, so not far from Liverpool, where you're playing a show. So maybe one or two people might have heard of him in that area.
That's what we're doing. We're trying to appeal to we're not trying to appeal to the masses, right? We're trying to appeal to the one guy in the back of the room that's ever heard of Keith Lampard.
Yeah, well, it would be me, surely. But if there's anybody else, then I'll be their friend thereafter. So right,
I'm gonna look that guy up.
Yeah, do it. Yeah, there's a good Sabre biography of him. We've tried to get hold of him, but he's a very old gentleman now, and I think he doesn't look at his emails too often.
Yeah.
So you were a baseball player yourself, as you mentioned, that you modeled yourself on Ray Ordóñez as a shortstop, and you played to a pretty competitive level as a young guy. So what was it that made you choose to be a punk rock musician as opposed to a baseball player?
Well, it kind of made its choice for me. I was never as good as Ray Ordóñez, of course. And I wasn't going to go to college for it, and I wasn't probably going to get drafted. So I kind of just like faded out of baseball at a time. Like I think I was 17 years old, and that happened to be a time when I was getting into music a lot more, and kind of just that natural point in a teenager's life where it's like you gravitate toward new things, you know. And being in a band seemed like a really cool thing to do at the time, and I just went with that. But I never missed a season of baseball. I think I've missed a season of baseball once in my life, like not playing in some capacity. So I never really like fell out of it. It was just more of a transition of priority. And through my 20s, I was really into being in a band and, you know, taking the isotopes to a new place. And obviously, as you get older, there's less and less opportunity to play baseball at a competitive level. So you get stuck playing in softball leagues and stuff like that. And I was never really interested in that. So we created our own baseball league, the Isotopes. We created our own baseball league in Vancouver for guys like us who wanted to play hardball. Mm-hmm. And now that's how I'm spending a lot of my time with that. So I've kind of found a way to balance out my life with the band and baseball now.
And that works. So what's going to happen to the baseball league whilst you're in the UK then? Is that going to carry on? Is it just going to be missing its skipper?
Well, essentially we have a group of us. There's three guys who run the league. So I can be absent as long as I'm available, you know, in contact with them, you know, through technology and the internet and stuff. Hmm. It's all good.
And so how many teams have you got playing in that league?
This is our third, I guess it's our second official season, and we've grown to 10 teams. So we have 10 teams based in East Vancouver, all primarily made up of guys who are into music or the arts around the city. So it's all kind of like-minded people. And everyone's coming back to baseball after years of not playing. And so it's a hardball league. We use wood bats. There's no funny rules. It's just baseball. And it's a lot of fun. And there's nothing else like it that's going on, not in the city anyway. So it needed to exist, and we created it. So it's been very cool. But getting back into playing hardball like that for everybody is it's a slow kind of grind. But, you know.
Yeah, it is absolutely. As someone who's tried to do it and failed miserably, you know, I think I went to sea 20 years ago, and I'm only in my early 30s. So, it's amazing that you guys have come back to it, and you're managing to sort of grind it out and have a lot of fun with it, because it is a sport that it sometimes doesn't feel like fun, even when it's supposed to be, because it's so damn hard.
It's very hard and it's very slow. So you kind of have to, I always take a mental approach to it, and I've described it as like, it's a physical game of chess, right? There's always something to think about, and there's always something to prepare yourself for, but you're not always active in the field, obviously. So yeah, there's a lot of downtime, but you can fill that with just thinking about the game.
So we've heard that you take your baseball very seriously. And I understand that spills over into the band itself too. So, you know, you're on stage in the jerseys, in the baseball caps, fully kitted out. And I actually understand that one or two former members of your band have maybe chosen to move on because they weren't quite so keen on that. Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, like I've said this a million times, even to the guys in the band, is we're not like going out there reinventing the wheel musically. You know, we're a pop punk band in a genre that is full of a sea of pop punk bands, and separating ourselves and distinguishing ourselves within the genre is not going to happen musically. Like we're just, you know, we're not that band. But what we can do is be creative in other ways and be original in other ways. And that's kind of how we found the success and found fans and stuff like that. And that's by being, you know, this baseball themed band, which is very, like, it's very authentic and genuine. We're all fans of this, but you know, we've had over 40 members in the band. So
wow.
Every once in a while, there's someone who's not quite buying into the whole thing, and they've found themselves on their ass on the street. You know, if they don't want to wear a hat on stage, and then I'm just like, well, then you can join another band, you know, like, cause this is what we do here. And you know, it would be like going out on the field and refusing to wear your hat or your uniform. It's just, it's a weird choice to make. You know, if you're in on something, then you should be in on it. And if you're not, then you can leave. Like it's people's choice, right? But this is what we do. And I think every band has, from what I know and what I've talked to people, every band has their set of expectations, whether it's, you know, whether it's wearing a hat or any other thing. You don't go into a band and like reject the program, right? So I think it's the same for any band, but we've had our share of problems as far as wardrobe go, certainly, yes.
Yeah, I have to say, I do think I follow the wrong sport religiously, because I unfortunately have a head that just can't wear hats. Any hat that you put on it makes me look like a Burke. So I'd get in your band, and I think I'd be shooed out of every single clubhouse that I tried to enter as soon as I arrived. You'd be like, no, take your hair away, put a hat on. So, thank the instruments. So, you know, we're not going to have to cross that bridge. But I understand you were talking started the chat that you do have a member of Bristol at the moment. So that's interesting.
Well, yeah, we have, as I've mentioned, we have a rotating roster of dudes who play in this band. And one of the guys who did our last European tour with us, Richie Rounders, his name is. Mm-hmm. He gets his name Rounders from his upbringing. He was born and raised in Bristol. So he, you know, he's kind of our tie to the UK. I don't think he's going to be on this tour. In fact, I can tell you for sure he's not, but he'll be there with us in spirit. And it was very interesting meeting a guy from that part of the world who he wasn't necessarily a baseball fan when he grew up there, but moving out here, he has developed a love for it. And he's one of the guys in the band I can really talk baseball with the most now.
That's awesome. So what age was he when he moved over to Vancouver?
I think he moved out here after high school. So he was able to kind of get the best of both worlds, I think. And he's still got his thick English accent. And
yeah.
And he hasn't lost that, and it's great. So he's a fun guy to talk to.
Yeah, it's a very not that many people over in North America seem to pick it up, but it's a very, very thick and distinctive accent down in that part of the UK as well. I'll have you know. So if he's kept that, then that's a treat.
No, he's great.
Yeah, and you are playing in Bristol. So it's a little bit of a shame that he's not going to be able to join you, but I'm sure you can give him a shout out nevertheless.
It's true. We were supposed to do the UK on our last tour, so he was excited about that. But on this one, it's not happening for him. So, I mean, like I said, we have so many guys. We basically run the band like a baseball team where, you know, the shows have to happen. The shows will go on, and we will work with the lineup of guys that's available on any given set of dates. And that's a good way to go if you want momentum to maintain. If you want to maintain momentum, it's been working for us anyway.
Great. So I wanted to just ask you more generally about the bond between baseball and punk and hardcore, if we can pull that in, because there is kind of something there. You know, we've got Ian McKay and Steve Albini, who are both like notoriously huge baseball fans. The Yankees suck t-shirts that were, you know, everywhere in the early 2000s. They came out of the Boston hardcore scene. They were guys who started that. Scott Rudinsky, of course, famously is both a punk rocker and a baseball player and coach. So why do you think that is? Why is it baseball that's the sport that the sort of punk and hardcore community seems to bond with?
Well, I think that both baseball and punk kind of attract an intellectual crowd. You know, not explicitly or exclusively, but they do for what they do. For sports and for music, I think that both of them attract more intellectuals than the average genre or sport. So in that way, I think there's a like a similarity between the two, because baseball is a very like thought-provoking game. It's a thinking man's sport, they say, right? And punk is very much like that too. And so I just think it's a personality type, honestly, that kind of can see merits in both. And in punk, there's kind of always been this punk and hardcore, I think, well, maybe less hardcore, but there's certainly this thing where there's a separation between like musicians or punks and jocks, right? And it's kind of been a taboo thing. You can't like sports if you like punk or whatever. But baseball kind of gets a pass on it because of its, I think maybe just it's different in nature than other sports. It's just not so ham-fisted. It's not just bashing sticks against other people, or you know, like, you know, it's more about strategy than it is about physicality in a lot of ways, even though it's a very demanding physical sport. There's just something about it that plays well with people who like to think and people who like, you know, good music, I guess.
yeah, I guess so. Yeah, and then there's an affinity across everything. Maybe it is because of that sort of that front office element, because I don't think I don't know if many of the players are punk rock fans. Certainly when I've been out there, you hear a lot of very, very sort of scrungy hip hop and a lot of Southern country from the guys who, you know, are going to be out there, you know, shooting a deer next week. So maybe yeah. It's more front office guys who are punks.
I was asked to, like, I was watching a baseball game the other day with my lady, and she asked me why all these guys wear such terrible, gaudy jewelry, and you know, my answer was like, because these guys have been pent up in a locker room like their whole lives with a bunch of other dudes who also have terrible taste and basically exposed to zero culture in their life, you know, other than what's around them. Like, so it doesn't really go both ways. Baseball players really don't get exposed to too much culture unless they go out and really seek it. But from an early age, these guys are pretty much like steered toward one thing, which is to be athletes and not focus on any other interests. So it doesn't really go both ways. You're right. And it is rare to see a guy like Scott Rudinsky who was able to make a success out of both things. But musicians have a lot of downtime, and they have a lot of downtime that athletes don't have. So they have chances to pursue other hobbies and interests and stuff. So yeah, so it just doesn't go both ways.
Yeah, that's interesting that you say that, and it sort of brought to mind. I remember, I'm a Boston Red Sox fan, and a few guys I remember having a bit of a go at Drew Pomeranz for going to an army and putting it on Instagram because, you know, that's not normal baseball player behavior. You can imagine the Boston sports media loving that. If he was out there with a gun holding up, you know, whatever he'd shot, it'd be fine. But he's in an art gallery. How dare he? How dare he have other pursuits?
That's right. I mean, it becomes a branding issue and some kind. You're representing your team and the league at all times when you're one of these high profile players, you know. So anything that you do is going to be kind of looked at as a representation of your team and of your employer, essentially. And that's what these guys are. And they don't really get time off to pursue personal interests or at least display them publicly, right? So you get scrutinized for every little thing. And if it's not consistent with the MLB brand, which is, it seems like their target demographic is like very boring middle-class white people, right? They don't want to see, that kind of thing mostly. And it's tough, but you can understand it from a corporate perspective as well, where they don't have time to, you know, to deal with, you know, people who promote things that aren't in line with what they do. So it's just a weird thing when you get players who want to have personalities, but then they can't. The trade-off is getting to be a professional baseball player, I suppose, right? So you can learn to live with a lot of stuff if you're being paid in zillions of dollars to play baseball.
Absolutely. Other than Scott Rudinsky, who is the famous one, is there any player, current or past, who you're aware of, who you would say is a big sort of punk hardcore fan? Anyone else that you know about?
Yeah, I think Tim Lincecum is the kind of guy that would go to a punk show, you know, or at least a rock show. Mm-hmm. And who else? Maybe I got that feeling or info about Eric Sogard at one point. Yeah, it's the kind of thing that you really like. If you hear about it, you make a mental note of it. And I haven't heard too much about that at all.
Well, those are both Bay Area guys, so they're in the right place for a lot of punk music, I guess. Maybe that's it.
I think so. Yeah, that's true. It's certainly down there the most. But yeah, I mean, it's obviously something that you don't hear a lot about. Most guys are not into punk, and probably for good reason.
Yeah, it's that that clubhouse preservation thing, I guess.
And now also, like, don't forget, these guys are a lot younger than we are now. Like, these guys are, you know, 18 to 25, and they did not grow up with punk in the mainstream the way that we did. Where I'm 33 years old, and I don't know how old you are, but we grew up with punk in the mainstream, right? Like, you could not turn on the radio without hearing Green Day or The Offspring or Nirvana or things like that, where that was like a gateway access to underground punk bands. Whereas it's not like that at all. So these guys aren't even exposed to that. So there's no reason for them to gravitate toward punk at all, I don't think.
Well, that's a shame, but I'm glad you picked those two, because those are both favorites of ours. Certainly one of the guys who does the podcast with us is a big Tim Lincecum fan. And Eric Sogard is a member of our favorite group of baseball players, or certainly my favorite group of baseball players, which is baseball players in glasses, for obvious reasons. You and I can see each other. I'm wearing a pair of glasses. So I have a big affinity with slightly wonkish looking baseball players in glasses. So I'm glad Eric Sogard's into good music. That makes me like him even more than I already did. Okay, so I've got one last question, which is a question from a listener of the podcast, Mike Shipp. So he asks, do you have a favorite song with a baseball quote or reference in it that isn't one of your own?
Yeah, I can absolutely say that I do. It is a song by a band called Screeching Weasel, and mm-hmm. one of my favorite bands since I've been into music, and they have a song called Bottom of the Ninth, which mm-hmm. is a great metaphorical baseball song. It uses baseball to, you know, talk about life in a very pointed way. And it's a short song, but it always kind of struck me as a great tune because I was able to identify with it on both the literal and metaphorical sense. So that's kind of the song that comes to mind when you ask me that question. But it's a great song. It's called Bottom of the Ninth by Screeching Weasel. Check it out.
I absolutely will. I do know Screeching Weasel, but I do not know that song, so I will definitely go. And for the record, Mike said that his was, despite the Yankees connection, he'd go for a Black Train Jack. Okay, I don't know that song.
I don't know if I know that song either, but
check it out. We'll both go and check it out, and certainly Mike, when you listen to this, make sure you check out Screeching Weasel because they're a lot of fun. So right, that's it. We're through, but I just want to make sure that we make sure that everyone knows where they can get to one of your shows. So the tour starts in London on the 26th of August at the brilliant Camden Underworld, which is a great venue. I don't know if you've played there before, Evan, but you'll have a lot of fun. It's always a really really boisterous crowd in that venue. And it's going everywhere across the UK during the end of August and during September, from Liverpool to Dublin, right up to Aberdeen, right at the very tip of Scotland. So we'll post all the dates up again on our Twitter. We've already done that. We'll make sure that it's on the site as well. But in the meantime, before anyone goes and books a ticket, which we hope they all do, is there anywhere that people can find you online and have a listen to some of your music, Evan?
Yeah, absolutely. I would start by going to Instagram and just searching for us at The Isotopes. That's the easiest way. We're very active on Instagram and post tour dates and new songs and stuff up there. But otherwise, we're on iTunes. Like everybody, search The Isotopes. And Spotify, too. If you're on Spotify, we are on Spotify. So pretty much anywhere you like to find music, you can find it. And do YouTube as well. You know, it's all out there. So please do. And thank you very much.
Absolutely, definitely. So thank you very much for your time this morning in Vancouver, British Columbia, Evan October, and we'll see you again in August.
Yes, sir. It's been a pleasure. Thanks a lot for having me on the show.
No problem. Okay, so that's Evan October. It was great to hear from him. He was a really lovely guy. Certainly knows his oats about baseball and made me feel like I really didn't at a couple of points during that conversation. I'll leave you to decide exactly where I find depth between yourselves. So yeah, make sure that you go out and check them on the road in August and September in the UK and give them a listen on YouTube or on iTunes or any of those places that Evan mentioned at the end of the chat. Anyway, enough well on that, guys. A little bit more MLB UK. So, Nick, not the only reason that we've got you here, because a big baseball guy, but specifically, you wrote an article, I think, a couple of weeks ago this Monday, just gone, about what MLB are doing to try and find a place here in the UK. You spoke to some really interesting people. You spoke to Charlie Hill, who runs the MLB office here. You spoke to Carlos Pena and to Liam Carroll, the GB baseball coach. So just can you just sort of summarize what it is that you were trying to ask them about and what it is that you found from them?
Yeah, I was just, it's such a sort of interesting idea of introducing what is not quite a brand new sport, but is still, will still be a very kind of niche sport into, and we're going to start talking about things like markets and so on, which is a bit bit uncomfortable, but into a sports market that is already quite sort of saturated. There are obviously sports that have great historical and cultural roots in the UK. One of the things that I wanted to talk about in the article is how they were going to sort of get around the one of the kind of key sort of appeals of baseball in the US is that it's such a sort of fabric of their society. It has been, you know, they still refer to it as a national pastime, has been since however long, you know, late 1800s. I was just interested as to what the MLB UK people were going to do to try and drum up enough interest to not only have a couple of games here in a few years, but to sort of embed themselves here, so they sort of coming over regularly like NFL do. As I said, I spoke to Charlie, spoke to a few other people from MLB UK. I mean, at the moment, their kind of policy seems to be sort of just basically throwing stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks. Obviously, the event at Hyde Park the other week was the first big one, but as you'll know, they've had a pop-up store in Covent Garden in London. They've had this slightly odd-looking virtual reality batting cage that they put in Brixton Market for a few days around the time of the Hyde Park event. They seem to be sort of trying things out at the moment. They've got the games are sort of penciled in for 2019, so they've got a couple of years to kind of build up to this. So I was just interested in talking about what they were doing to convince the UK that they should be paying some more attention to baseball.
Did you get a sense that they are aware of the magnitude of the challenge that confronts them? Like, not only are they competing, as you said, in a market that's got a lot of sports that people already enjoy traditionally, but where one or two of the other American sports, particularly NFL, is becoming increasingly popular. They're aware of that, right? And I think from the conversations that we've had with them, what they're trying to do is to put their own spin, and that's why they're doing some of these weird and wonderful things to draw attention to themselves in the first place. Is that something that came across in the conversations you had?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, they're aware that they can't, using the word marketing, they're aware that they can't market it really in the way that you would traditionally market a sport. They have to try new things. They have to sell this as a sort of cultural experience rather than necessarily just a sporting event. They have to sell this as something, you know, a big event that you can go to rather than trying to educate people about the minutiae of the rules of the game. And in fact, this was something they mentioned in the piece, that they are kind of very deliberately not going to lecture people on, you know, the intricacies of what constitutes a balk and, you know, the unwritten rules of, you know, why you're allowed to throw the ball at someone's back if it displeased you in some way. Their plan is, and this will obviously rely on it being a success to some degree, the plan is to just let people discover that kind of thing on their own. They can either just watch games and discover them, you could read a book about it or whatever. So they're aware that it is, in that respect, it's a very tricky sport to explain. And it sounds a little bit glib, but the way they're getting around it is they're not going to try and explain it, which is, so that seems to be the approach at the moment anyway.
Yeah, I think that's eminently sensible. We've all, I'm sure, three of us here have had a number of infernal conversations where, you know, we found ourselves trying to explain some pointless rule or unwritten rule to people who are like, "Well, why is that how it is?" And the answer is just that, well, it just is. So just deal with it, right?
And that's true of any sport. You can, you know, yeah. If you're good friends, as I am, with people who don't care about football, they will say, "Well, why has that happened?" And you go, "Well, okay, it's because of this reason." And they kind of look at you like a sort of, you know, dog that's just been shown a card trick, and they can't, they don't understand why this explanation that you've given, which seems perfectly sensible to you, is the kind of universally accepted fact. So that's a problem that any sport has, I think.
So you, as I mentioned there, you spoke also to Liam Carroll, who we've had on the podcast a number of times. He's a great advocate for the sport of baseball in the United Kingdom and doing great things as the coach of the national baseball team. Did you get a sense of him feeling that this development was really important for his program and for the growth of the grassroots game as well? And what were his views about how and why this was important and how it could present opportunities for he and his guys?
Yeah, before I spoke to him, I was sort of, I don't know, concerns is quite the right word, but I thought he might be maybe resentful of the fact that because MLB UK and MLB Europe's focus before all this has broadly been on participation and getting, you know, directing funding towards getting people actually playing the game. I wondered whether he wouldn't appreciate that they have, you know, been distracted by this shiny new bauble. But he seems to have taken, at least when he spoke to me anyway, seems to have taken the kind of pragmatic view that if baseball is more pragmatic and, you know, perfectly logical view, that if baseball is more obvious and is more prominent in sort of British sporting culture, then more people will want to play it. And that obviously can only, you know, benefit him. So I was kind of slightly surprised about how, very slightly surprised about how positive he was about the whole thing. As I said, I anticipated just maybe a little bit of kind of reticence or resentment, but he didn't seem to have that at all.
Yeah, I don't think that's the type of guy that he is. I think he's very much an optimist who'll take any opportunity he has to put baseball across in a good light, and he certainly does so. Before we sort of move on to some comparisons, I'm interested, particularly with you being a big football guy and a big football fan yourself, to talk a little bit about whether there are any comparisons, and MLS was the one that sprung to mind. But just before we touch on that, I'm going to put Ben on the spot because he's kind of tangentially involved in some of this now. And Ben, don't betray any confidences and don't you know, put yourself in a position where you're going to lose your job. But do you think that what Ben said is right, that there is this sort of sense that you guys at Engage and the guys in the MLB office have got a bit of a license to just sort of try things out and see what works, particularly over the next 12 months or so?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm nowhere near close to the levels of people who are making these important decisions. You know, I'm just a dutiful minion who may lose his job if I say something wrong in this conversation. But what I will say is that the task that Charlie seems to be given is a broad one, which in some ways is nice for him and for the other guys who are involved at Engage and Imagination and the other groups that have been recruited by MLB. But in some ways it's really tough when MLB says to you, you know, do you think there's a market there? Can you, you know, investigate over the next year whether people in the UK will take to this sport, whether there's enough traction there to potentially host games in the future? And you give him that kind of broad canvas. I mean, where do you even begin? And I remember when we talked to him back at the sort of launch party in February, and he mentioned this idea of a Hyde Park home run derby right when it was sort of at its conception. Even then it was sort of like he was just thinking, this is out of the blue, a total, it might not work, it might work kind of thing, because that's all he can really go off. You know, we've got these blueprints like NFL, like NBA, but these sports were, I think, at least considerably more popular before, you know, these foundations even launched, these sort of programs even launched, and these programs were launched, you know, well over a decade, 15, 20 years ago in the NFL's case. So it's tough for him and for the MLB, and it's tough for companies like Engage to know what exactly we can do to show that there's support here and whether there is that kind of grassroots interest in the sport. But I'd like to think that events like MLB Battlegrounds and what these other sort of contractors are doing are at least paving the way for games in the future and trying to get all these fans like me, like you, into the open and saying, actually, this isn't something I need to follow on my own. This is something that I can follow with a number of fans and with only luck see a game in the UK in a couple of years' time. But it is so sort of unfounded that it's hard to say whether it's going well and whether MLB themselves will look at it and go, that's good, or they'll look at it and go, that's crap. So it's hard to say.
Yeah, I promised Charlie on the 4th that I would let him have a couple of weeks sleep before I was back in touch, handing him about what was going to happen next. So he has promised to come on the podcast. So maybe we can get an opportunity to sort of metaphorically poke him with a stick in a couple of weeks' time and hear what's going to come next. I mentioned there, Nick, I don't know if you're an MLS follower yourself, but I know you're certainly a man who knows an awful lot about football. And that for me, I thought was the most direct and interesting comparison. As a sport that just had no foundation whatsoever in a country that where they kind of, you know, they took the World Cup there and then they set up a domestic league. And 25 years later, I mean, it really is that long. It now has, you know, a decent standing and a good following. So, are there any lessons perhaps to learn from that about, you know, the time and duration and effort that has to go in to make something like this stick?
And it's obviously not just the World Cup in 94 was one thing, but they obviously tried the North American Soccer League in the 70s. Yeah. And I think that's there are some points of comparison with that, because when they were setting up that, they used some of the kind of few things that people had actually heard of. So in that case, it was people like Pelé. People kind of knew who he was, so they brought him over to New York at great expense and tried to kind of create a kind of individual stars around that. With MLB in the UK, they're kind of in a sort of vaguely similar fashion. They seem to have, or this is what Charlie said anyway, seem to have kind of considered what people already know about, which they know about the kind of the brand of the Yankees or the Dodgers, basically through people wearing the baseball caps, people having no real knowledge about what that, you know, that LA or the NY symbol actually specifically stands for, but they recognize it and they can associate it with a kind of slice of Americana. So in that respect, they are there might be some sort of comparisons to how they initially tried to push soccer in America in the 1970s. I'm not sure. I might be wrong about this. I'm not sure there's anything sort of direct that they will or can take from MLS in the last sort of quarter century. But as we've discussed, they're trying things out at the moment. So who knows what could happen at various points.
Yeah, I think I have to say, I think we're a long, long way away from a domestic league of the quality of MLS, even one that has its knockers in this country. I think that the standard of that, and this is no knock on the guys who are turning out in the NBL or even in AA, Ben. But I think that some of the players in MLS certainly have a bit more chops, even Liam Ridgewell. Marquee player Liam Ridgewell still makes me chuckle. Right, so yeah, was there anything else on that, Nick, that you thought was interesting that you wanted to just touch on before we move on to talk a bit about what's been happening this week in baseball?
I think the thing that one of the things that I found interesting, one of the kind of main questions I wanted to ask before I went in, was this problem that has been discussed quite a lot in America about the kind of face of baseball. Mm. That there are very few kind of cross-culture marketable stars in baseball, in the same way that, you know, the basketball has LeBron James and Steph Curry, and there's Tom Brady in NFL and whatever else. So it was in that respect. I was interested to know how they were kind of planning to sort of get around the idea that the best player in baseball, the guy that they should theoretically be able to market, is quite a dull man. He
looks like the Pillsbury Doughboy.
He looks like the Pillsbury Doughboy, and he, you know, seems to have a kind of David Beckham-esque quality of talking while saying absolutely nothing. So, but again, the Charlie said that the way they were planning to get around that was to not sort of address it, really, because that there's not a lot of point in trying to market a man that, you know, or any kind of player that no one's ever heard of, particularly if he hasn't got much of a kind of outward personality. So they will rely on marketing the teams rather than any individual players, which I thought was interesting and kind of perfect, logical, and sort of I wondered why I didn't think of it that way before I spoke to him.
Yeah, absolutely. I read that, and I've also subsequently heard Charlie say the same thing in an interview with Nat Coombs. And again, I kind of kicked myself for not making the same logical step, because, you know, we've talked ad nauseum on this podcast about that lack of a person to hang it on. If you're not going to be able to bring Alex Rodriguez or David Ortiz, who, you know, more than a handful probably of people will have heard of in the UK, who are you going to bring? But yeah, that's it. Absolutely. As you mentioned earlier on in the conversation, you see a New York Yankees hat every day, no matter where you are. They even have them in Stockport. I'm not sure if they're official merchandise. Right. Yeah, I think that is an interesting point, and I think that has to be the right way of doing it. And it'll be interesting to see how they develop that in terms of, you know, getting the product to use the, we're back to markets and marketing. That's the way that they use it. Product. Good God. Anyway, leaving product over there, I think, is a good place to leave that conversation. And from awful management speak to horrible language of an entirely different sort, I just wanted to stop off before we got back onto the conversation that we thought we were going to have, to give a nod to a friend of the podcast, John Lackey, the man with more homers than a Simpsons back catalogue this season. I just wanted to make a pause to point out, if you haven't seen what John Lackey said this week about his current status, that he won't be going into the bullpen. He will be retiring before he goes into the bullpen. Just another notch on the already falling apart log that is the John Lackey is a bell end campaign. So yeah, I doubt that you two have much to add to that. But there we go. I felt like we couldn't have a podcast without at least giving John Lackey another kick in at least one shin. So there we are.
you'd want to see John Lackey when he is genuinely angry about something, because he always looks angry about something or other. When the Red Sox were in the World Series a few years ago, he looked furious throughout the whole thing. So if they did actually say, John, you're going in the pen now, what I'd like to see what he would do in that situation. Maybe just kind of, you know, storm out of the park and drive and keep on driving, never to be seen again.
I'd quite like to be a fly on the wall during that conversation between Lackey and Joe Maddon. You've got my two favourite people in baseball in one conversation there. John, you're going in the pen, but the bonus is that you do get to wear this special jumper that I've had commissioned especially for you. How do you feel about that? You just, you know, the air would be turning blue, wouldn't it? Yeah, John Lackey, do you think John Lackey has ever been happy?
I'm always fascinated with Lackey because whenever you see him, he looks particularly angry. And I think we can agree on this podcast, at least, he's a very hateable character in what he says and how he acts on the field. But in interviews I've heard, because he's at the age now where a lot of his former contemporaries are retired and sort of doing the rounds in terms of media representation. And the interviews I've heard with his former contemporaries all seem to have nice things to say about him. They all, you know, oh, he's a hard competitor, but he's a lovely guy, you know, family man. Admittedly, there was an interview with, I heard the other day, with AJ Pierzynski, who himself, not the most likable baseball character, but he talked about how Lackey was a lovely bloke. He didn't have any particularly hilarious stories regarding Lackey, but I don't know if there's an unwritten baseball code that you don't slag off your, you know, former teammates, but I've never heard an actual bad word about him from his teammates. So maybe he, behind the scenes, is a hilarious and extremely happy character, but I do find that hard to believe.
Yeah, I don't believe it. Maybe he's good if you're going hunting, a topic that came up several times in the conversation that I had with Evan, which you guys are going to have to tune in to listen to. He was quite lucid and interesting on why everyone in a baseball clubhouse is the same and none of them ever speak about one another. So you hear Evan's theory, you want to download the podcast, but whether you want to listen to your own voices, and I know that from the conversation we had beforehand, none of us are particular fans.
No, we can. We could just listen to the interview and then cut it off before we start talking. So that
yeah,
all good. That'll
work. Yeah. So leaving John Lackey where he belongs and going across Chicago, or sort of across Chicago, but maybe across to the East Coast. I just wanted to get both of your reaction to the trade of Todd Frazier, David Robinson, and Tommy Conley to the New Prize earlier this week, not least because everyone was convinced that Todd Frazier was going to be ending up in Boston. Tom about this, because of course Tom is our resident Red Sox expert, but given he's not here, Nick, you're Red Sox soft spot. So do you want to sort of step in and rescue the situation in terms of what you think as a Red Sox guy about this trade? So thing myself.
Well, from a Red Sox perspective, I wasn't kind of particularly, I was going to cry myself to sleep that he wasn't kind of joining the Red Sox. Cause, I mean, I confess I haven't delved deeply into the numbers this season, but he didn't seem to be doing particularly well this season. I mean, it might have kind of, plugged the gap for a short while until Rafael Devers is kind of ready to kind of step up, which might be the end of the season, might be next, might be even further than that. But from a Red Sox perspective, I'm not going to cry myself to sleep that he's now a Yankee. Whether he'll solve the Yankees' problems either third or first, they seem to have, don't seem to be getting anything a great deal from either of those positions at the moment. Who knows? It's the kind of odd trade that sometimes just works out for no particular reason. You kind of plug a guy in there and suddenly he starts hitting. But who knows? I'm sure there was a logic to it.
And I think certainly those two relievers are probably prizes in their own right as well. Tom posted a rather eye-watering stat earlier in the week that the Yankees now have the top five relievers by strikeout rate in the MLB in a single bullpen.
Insane.
Which, if you're in the AL East and due to face the Yankees a number of times over what about the White Sox, Ben? They're certainly having some teardown, aren't they?
Yeah, I really like what the White Sox are doing. Rick Hahn, actually, after this trade, talked about how he pieced, Frazier and the two bullpen pieces together in one trade because he felt like he could get, a bigger return when he put a bigger package together himself, which makes, in my mind, a lot of sense. He got Blake Rutherford, I think, was the centerpiece of the deal, who I'm not going to pretend to know much about. But according to, experts, he's a fairly highly graded prospect. And I find it hard to believe he would have been returned had the package just been Frazier or just been Robertson and Conley. So he's done a nice job there of getting the maximum return from his assets. And given the position the White Sox are in, it makes total sense to blow up the major league roster, sell off whatever valuable assets you have and rebuild for the future. And there's been a number of sort of stats going around about their number of top 100 prospects they have now and how deep their farm system is. And whilst there's no such thing as a guaranteed prospect, as we've seen far too often in recent years, when you've got the kind of system they have now, you can't help but look at 2020, 2021 and think, this team could be a real force to reckon with, and their cross-city neighbours will attest to the power of a full rebuild because it's worked out rather well for them in recent years.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe that's what they've been doing and why they were so happy to send a piece like Jose Quintana across the city as well. Yeah, I read that article with Hahn's explanation, and I thought it was quite clever. Certainly from a Red Sox perspective, the names that were getting bandied about is potentially being in a one-up deal for Frazier, that you wouldn't be too sad to see them being removed from the Red Sox battery. If it was Henry Owens, certainly you would be glad to see them going, but it wasn't him.
don't kick Henry Owens. He looks sad enough as it is.
He's got a really sad face, hasn't he? He looks like Plug from the Bash Street Kids. I wonder if he knows that. I wonder if that's a reference that crossed over the pond.
I was thinking he looks like the guy who plays like the bloke who works in 7-Eleven in American teen dramas. He's just this kind of lank-haired, slightly kind of dopey-looking guy who just stands there and hands over your 7-Up or something.
he does. He looks like him too, definitely. Yeah. He's in every single one, Superbad and all of them. He's in every single one.
Yeah, right.
So moving on from Henry Owens, I just wanted to touch on, there's been a couple of teams who were kind of scuffling a bit coming out of the All-Star break, who are a bit of a surprise, one of which is the Red Sox, who, in case those of you listening have missed it, are batting a collective 217 since the All-Star break, and still, still amazingly, at time of recording, are in a positive win differential over that period, although it does look like they're going to lose to the Blue Jays this evening. Cleveland also on a bit of a mini skid. They've lost the last couple and lost more games than they've won since the All-Star break. And they're still only half a game ahead of what is an absolutely awful division. So is this just baseball is baseball and good teams are bad for a bit, or do you think that this is going to cause a bit of a pivot at the trade deadline, Ben?
I think it's baseball is baseball to a certain extent. Obviously, the All-Star game was only, you know, 10 days ago or so now, and anything can happen over that stretch, and it'd be wrong of teams to panic on the basis of a 10-game run. I'm most concerned about the Indians, to be honest with you, just because, as you mentioned, that division is so weak. They should be, you know, 10, 15 games clear, much like the Nationals are in the NL East, and it hasn't really happened for them this year. And teams like the Twins, who have no right being competitive, and the Royals, who we all presume are going to be blowing it up and rebuilding, are now probably thinking maybe we can be buyers, because you don't particularly need to win 95 games to win this division the way it's panning out right now. So there should be a reasonable cause for concern for Cleveland. Ultimately, I think they're good enough. They are going to win the division probably at a canter, but they might be persuaded into a couple of sort of panic buys at the deadline to shore up that rotation, definitely. As for the Red Sox, I'll leave it up to you and Nick to provide more analysis on that, because I haven't been watching them a lot, but I still have them down as division favourites. But I imagine there's a fair bit of pressure on that front office now to do a bit of wheeling and dealing now that the Yankees have made a couple of swoops.
Yeah, I would say so. So the Red Sox are three games up in the division above the surprise package that is the Tampa Bay Rays. We've been going on about for a bit of a while, lost to us. What do you think, Nick, as someone who's been watching the Red Sox this year? It's been, I'm sure that you share my frustration in this lineup, absolutely raking, but just seems to be missing David Ortiz in more ways than might have been expected, I guess.
Yeah, I guess, excuse me. I guess so. I mean, from a sort of trade perspective, it's a little bit difficult to know what exactly they could do to make a significant sort of difference to the team. The obvious spot is third base, but you know, who are they realistically going to be able to trade for? I can't. You know, unless I'm missing someone incredibly obvious, I can't think of anyone that is realistic. If you know the sort of price that Baltimore will want to, you know, start with for Manny Machado, who, you know, even if they even want to do the sensible thing and try and trade him at this point, I don't know whether the Red Sox would have the sort of the pieces left in the farm system to get someone like him. But I don't know. I don't know whether the All-Star break was just a kind of arbitrary cutoff point, and you know, if you take any 10 days out of the season at any point, then you can find a slightly iffy run like this. But I'm not kind of, like you, frustrated, but not massively concerned at the moment. I think probably Red Sox probably still win the division. Possibly won't be kind of in great style or, you know, with any great comfort, but I don't think there's any real cause.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I think that they're being propped up a bit by the weakness of the opposition to some extent, particularly those bottom two teams, Baltimore and Toronto, who have been really, really poor. And like you, I struggle to see where the right trade comes from for a big piece. Martin Prado is a name that's gone around a lot. And then I one or two Red Sox accounts were putting some absolutely disgusting packages together for a player who's pretty good, but he's not a superstar. And, you know, giving up the rest of the farm apart from Devers for a player like Martin Prado would kind of make me Welsh a little bit. But I think there are a couple of players, I'm thinking particularly Betts, Hany Ramirez, who just haven't quite been there, certainly at the level of production that they were last year. He, you know, the only way is up for them. So I don't see anyone other than the Red Sox winning the AL East. But how comfortable it's going to be is another question entirely. On that point, I think it's... you mentioned Manny Machado. I had one last question from ours before we ask some listener questions. Did either of you have a sort of hot take, big trade deadline surprise that you want to sort of fire out there as a sort of thought to be reckoned with? I mean, I'm not going to hold either of you to account for it, but is there anyone who's a name that you think if they get moved, it's going to be a surprise, but hey, maybe we shouldn't be so surprised. So Ben, how about you first?
There are a couple of guys who I think should get dealt that won't get dealt, but that's sort of a different question to when you're asking. I think a guy to look out for is Michael Fulmer of the Tigers, a starting pitcher, because I've heard his name mentioned a fair bit in rumors, especially now JD Martinez has been shipped and Justin Verlander has been linked to various teams, because Fulmer has a much more attractive contract than Verlander does. And in my opinion, is the superior pitcher at this point. He's been fantastic this year. And the Tigers pretty obviously didn't get entirely what they probably should have done for JD Martinez. And if the theory now is literally full rebuild and they do ship Fulmer, I think he could be a bargain to be had for a team. So I think he genuinely has ace upside. And I know Tigers fans will be hoping they don't let him go. But if a team really wants to go all in, I think he's got more upside than Sonny Gray does, and he comes at on a better deal. So if a team really wants to make a swing, I think that's a guy to target rotation-wise.
There you go. What do you reckon, Nick? Is Michael Fulmer going to go, and do you have another name to sort of just throw?
sorry, the internet dropped out there, so I completely missed everything that you just said in the last few minutes.
That's all right. So we were just talking whether there's a name who you think might be a big trade deadline surprise, not necessarily going to hold you to it, but is there a name that you that might not be getting mentioned as much as, say, a Verlander or a Sonny Gray who you think might move before the 31st of July? And Ben pitched Michael Fulmer, which is a good one. I hadn't even considered that he might be a name that goes.
Yeah, I think Fulmer's I've heard his name mentioned. I think he's... if they can... I've heard sort of people say that the starting price for him is kind of roughly what Andrew Miller went for around this time last year. So whether anyone's going to actually, pay that much, I don't know. But again, I don't want to kind of go bang on about Manny Machado, but it seems like he should be a name that should be kind of being bandied about all over the place. There doesn't seem to be anything kind of concrete at the moment that I've heard anyway. But you know, I think he's up for free agency at the end of next year. There's no way the Orioles are going to pay the, you know, upwards of $350 million or whatever it is that he would he would ask for. And it's another sort of complicated one in that he's not having a particularly good season at the moment. Mm. So. Maybe that's who knows. Maybe that's the reason that the Orioles aren't kind of marketing him as much as they perhaps should be. But I think he's a name that I haven't heard in terms of real kind of trade rumors that I think possibly should be a little bit more.
Yeah, I think I agree with you on that one. I find it gobsmacking that he's not of the trading block right now, because if I were Dan Duquette and sat in lovely Camden Yards, I'd be shopping. Let's have an auction. Let's get this massive headed guy off my roster and get some lovely prospects in. Fulmer's kind of go for a massively hot take and say I think Stanton will move. I think it's the first time that it's felt like a possibility ever that a team might be willing to take on that contract, possibly the Dodgers, possibly even, and this is kind of one to conjure with, maybe maybe Milwaukee, depending on how to think of that cash.
That is a piping hot take.
There you go. Giancarlo Stanton to Milwaukee. I think more likely is it's going to be Gray, possibly Fulmer. May have convinced me that if the asking price is Andrew Miller, that doesn't seem like an unreasonable overpay for a guy with his controllability and his upside and his salary. Who else? McCutcheon, possibly. Kind of depends on the next week. But I think Donaldson, but the same caveats apply to him as do Machado. He's a franchise player having a very poor year out of contract in 2018. But yeah, the next week for the Blue Jays is going to be an interesting where it is that they go. Strowman could even be on the block.
I've heard whispers about Jacob deGrom being shopped a little bit by the Mets, and that's, again, you know, a guy with ace upside who's on a pretty bad team right now who could change a team's fortunes this coming season.
Yeah, that's it. It's going to be Jacob deGrom, Giancarlo Stanton on the Milwaukee. Eric Thames, forget about it. We don't care anymore. Right, so that one got through. We'll answer some listener questions now. Some of these are a little bit more quirky and interesting than others, and we're going to start with a particularly interesting one, which is specific. A gentleman who goes by the rather excellent sobriquet of Ed Quoth the Raven asks, if you, Nick, were forced to wear a baseball glove for the rest of your life, the entire time, which position's baseball glove would you choose?
I was thinking about this, that what sort of glove do you want to be stuck with the rest of your life? You don't want something that's that gets used a great deal, as it's sort of old and battered, and you know, it's enough that you've got a baseball glove stuck to your hands without it being manky and smelling and everything else. So a pitcher's glove, surely it's not been used. It's used enough for the leather to be nice and worn in and soft. But it's used once every 5 days. You're only catching the ball usually when the catcher's throwing it back to you. So I'm going to go with a pitcher's glove. You don't want a shortstop who's going the thing's caked in mud and it's been used for dozens of years all the time. So yeah, I think I'm going to go with a pitcher's glove. One of the strangest questions I think that anyone's ever asked.
Yeah, I don't know. Even though it wasn't asked of us, I don't know if you had any thoughts yourself, Ben. I've got an answer, but before I offer my answer, I wondered about you, Ben.
I would probably go along the same lines that Nick did. You want something that's not too big and clumsy. I think a first baseman's glove would be uncomfortable. A catcher's glove's really heavy. You want an infielder's glove. It's a little bit smaller. It's sort of like having a big, really uncomfortable hand on top of your own hand, as opposed to a bigger sort of glove. So I haven't really thought about it a lot, I've got to say, but I go along the similar lines. I feel like you've got a really smart-ass answer up your sleeve, so I want to hear what it is.
Yeah, I have. I can be as wry as you, Mr. Ed Quoth the Raven. So, and in the spirit of the questioner, that I have a specific glove, not just a position glove. I have a specific glove. Now, you may not know this, but Dustin Pedroia famously gives his gloves names. And his favourite glove, the name of the glove was Spirit of the Witch. That was his favourite glove, which he used for very many years whilst he was playing in the MLB. So in the spirit of a question being asked by a gentleman called Ed Quoth the Raven, the glove that I would wear for the rest of my life, and surely because it's got magical properties, would be the Dustin Pedroia glove, Spirit of the Witch. So there you go. That's...
Is that just because you want to make what is already a conversation point even more of a conversation point by saying, yes, it's actually called Spirit of the Witch as well?
Exactly. It'll be like, what? Why are you wearing that glove? I think you'll find it's called Spirit of the Witch. And it's got magical powers. Why are you wearing it? Because a man called Ed Quoth the Raven told me to. There you go. Ed, you've been quite the star of the show, but we're going to move on. So, Jasmine Barber, a regular correspondent of the show and an all-round lovely person, asks, did the All-Star Game break teach you anything? And she goes on, has anything taught us anything? Has anything even changed, or has it been the same for the last month? Which I think is roundabout all the same question. I think generally that the All-Star Game break teaches us absolutely nothing. I think the All-Star Game is fun, but a lot of nonsense and far too much sort of projection and soundings and hot takes kind of come out of it. And I don't know about you guys, and if that's a widely held view amongst this conversation.
Sorry, you go ahead, Nick.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's just a kind of cultural thing that it is more of a like a point in the American sporting calendar, but I've never quite understood the appeal of the All-Star Game, and it just kind of gets in the way of proper baseball. Really, you're left with the better part of a week where there aren't actually any games that you want to watch, and. Whether the actual break has taught us anything, I don't know. It just seems to be a kind of fairly arbitrary point in the season that people, it's easy for people to point to. So yeah, I'm in agreement. I don't think it's taught us anything at all, really.
Yeah, what has it taught us? Aaron Judd at hitting the ball a long way. Yadier Molina has a great amount of self-regard. All of these.
My absolute favorite American sports phenomena is in baseball after the home run derby, when whichever home run derby participant doesn't come out the break going 6-10 immediately has their swing broken by the home run derby. So this year it is Aaron Judge, who went, what was it, like 1-16 when he came out, and he was robbed by Jackie Bradley Jr., you might remember, in a most ridiculous catch. And if that had landed, you probably would have had much better stats. But Yankees baseball Twitter is going absolutely insane, thinking that he's broken his swing, it'll be the same again, it's the home run derby's fault. And I quite like that.
Yeah. Seeing Yankees Twitter lose its collective mind over something completely stupid is always a fun watch lesson. Right. So Rob Novarar, who I can say your name absolutely right all the time now after you taught me Rob in person on the 4th of July, thank you very much, asks, who are the players that you think of as a bit rubbish but who are actually quite good? And he gave an example of Odubel Herrera, which is a bit of a shame because that was the first one that sprung to my mind as well. He looks like he's basically, on a bucking bronco in center field, but always seems to catch the ball. I don't know if, Ben, you had anyone that sprung to mind.
Yeah, a couple of mine are guys who sort of weren't very good a little while ago and have gotten good, and it's taken a while for my brain to adjust to that new reality. So the one that immediately springs to mind is Daniel Murphy of the Nationals, because he was like your prototypical second baseman, slap hitter, would maybe hit 280 in a season, nothing else, for like 5 or 6 years with the Mets. And now he's an unbelievable hitter. And in my head, when I watch him hit, I think he's a ground ball to second base waiting to happen. But he's putting up some extraordinary stat lines, and I don't think I've quite caught up with that yet. I still think it's a fluke, you know, like a year and a half later. And this season, Avisail Garcia of the White Sox, who I've long thought is just a crap version of Miguel Cabrera, is actually hitting quite well for the White Sox. And again, I refuse to believe it, but he keeps doing it. So I probably should adjust my brain to that reality. But it's going to take him years until he makes me come aboard.
I think a lot of these guys are second baseman, aren't they? Brian Dozier would be another one. You're like, yeah. How many home runs? Did you have anyone in mind, Nick?
Murphy was actually one of the ones that I thought of as well. Would have probably been a bit more relevant to the back end of last season, but Sandy Leon is one that he's not doing quite so well this season, but throughout the whole of last season, whenever I saw his name in the lineup, I just kind of assumed that someone was injured, and it took me a good few months to realise that no, actually, this guy's doing really well. He's actually the first choice catcher, and the other one, I don't know if this is this kind of too obvious, but based purely on aesthetics, Aaron Judge shouldn't be a baseball player. He doesn't look like he's one of those people that looks athletic but doesn't look like a sportsman. In that you know, he's obviously this kind of behemoth with sort of muscles the size of my thighs. But is it that sort of kind of figure that shouldn't be able to move around at any kind of useful speed or do anything that involves any dexterity. But not only is he, you know, very good at hitting a baseball very hard, but he seems to be a sort of vaguely competent fielder as well. So just looking at the man, you don't think he should be any good, but it turns out he is quite good.
Yeah, that's a good one. A rather different take on the question, but I think a very relevant and a very good one. I think always Submariners, anyone who's pitching from down there, it just looks all wrong. So Pat Neshek is probably top of the list this year. Brad Ziegler, of course, who we had at the Red Sox last year, would be another. But just for you, Ben, I couldn't let it slide. Gerardo Parra, a rubbish baseball player who is apparently now good. Yet another of them.
I don't know where it's coming from.
Yeah, no. But yeah, you're
how I didn't mention Hunter Pence, who constantly looks like he's fighting his own bat when he's in the batter's box. And yet year after year puts up pretty good stat lines. I don't think he's been quite as good this year. But that is a man who looks consistently scared of the fact he's on a baseball field and yet is apparently quite good.
Yeah, and also like one half of the Wet Bandit Malone, as I know we've mentioned several times hitherto. Right, so good question as always, Rob. From another Tampa Bay Rays fan, Paul Holland, what are the trades that should be made but probably won't be? I'll let you take that one, Ben.
So I don't have like a specific player-for-player trade in mind, but a guy who I think is a no-brainer trade candidate who doesn't seem to be generating a lot of buzz is Zach Cozart from the Reds, because admittedly this breakout season's kind of come out of nowhere for him, because he's previously been a glove-only guy who's not been particularly good at hitting. But this year he's been so good, and there are so many teams who don't have a shortstop that I can't help but think that teams should be biting the Reds' arm off for him, especially as he's a rental and wouldn't come too expensively. So off the top of my head, a team like the Rays could probably get him without giving up too many prospects. I don't see why teams wouldn't at least be inquiring. So I think Cozart ends the season as a Red, but I don't think he should.
Interesting. I don't think I agree with you. I think he will move. And where he'll go, I don't know. Who needs a shortstop of the contenders is kind of the question with Cozart, isn't it? We've already talked about Chardo and Donaldson and Stanton. I don't know if there was anyone else that you thought about, Nick, for that one, or whether it's just Machado again.
Yeah, I've blown my beans a little bit early on this one. I think Machado's the main one that really should be going somewhere, but probably won't. I don't know whether that's mainly because the most obvious place for him to go is probably the Red Sox, and you know, those two teams might not be on the friendliest of terms at the moment.
No, that's true. Yeah, I think you're right. I think, we could probably add Verlander to that list of should moves, but probably won't moves. I just can't see that one happening. Not in a month of Sundays. So yeah, good question, Paul. And another one from Paul was, is there a team that nobody is currently talking about who will make an unexpected run at a playoff place? Kind of depends on your definition of nobody's talking about, because nobody's talking about your Rays, Paul, because they're a load of old rubbish. but they probably will and should, I would say. I think the Rays are, and joking aside, I think the Rays, despite playing in front of nobody in, you know, a biscuit tin, are actually a good team. Any others from anybody else?
I think in the American League, there's so many teams that are kind of on the periphery of that wild card race that any of them could come into it. I mean, the Angels won a lot of games without Trout, which is weird. And now they've got Trout back, you'd think they'd win more, and they're still not completely out of it. So maybe they're a team that everyone kind of assumes will fall out of it, but might not. But I kind of find that hard to believe. But yeah, I think in that American League, all it takes is one team to win like 15 out of 20, and suddenly they're right in the middle of the wild card race. So without wanting to like name names, put myself on the spot, I think, yeah, the Angels are a team that should be kept an eye on, and maybe even the Rangers in that division too, because someone's going to have to take these wild card spots, and there aren't many teams that are putting their hands up for them right now. I think the NL is going to be a bit boring, unfortunately, because there seem to be five teams that are running away with it. Well, sorry, I say five. The NL Central was an absolute pile of shit, so who knows?
Hey, you, Carlos Stanton, led Brewers alone. So, like, the last question, I shall push this one in your direction, Nick. Which team has the coolest uniform and logo in the NL? One has the worst?
I'll take the worst first. Always the Diamondbacks. I think it seems to have been that way for forever. You can have seen footage of Randy Johnson and Curt Schilling when he was wearing those sort of uniforms with the pinstripes and the sort of dark sleeves, which I don't see that they look like any kind of sportswear at all. They shouldn't. I don't think they should be, you know.
City away kit, those.
They
look like a mid-90s Manchester City away kit.
They absolutely do. Yeah, they do. They really do. I would think I would lump. Maybe the Marlins as well into that. I'm not a big fan of their uniforms. The one I quite like is, for some reason, Pittsburgh's. There's something quite nice about the black and the yellow, do they say black or gold? I'm not sure. But I'm a big fan of those. And then, you know, for personal bias reasons, the Red Sox logo always makes me feel warm inside.
I was going to say you can't pick your...
Oh.
But give let you off. Ben, obviously, the Rockies are the best, as you've mentioned several times. But... any of that's probably quite high up your list of horrors as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of odd in that I really like the terrible uniforms. So the ones that always stand out to me are the absolute horror shows that the Athletics put on every now and then, because they have some horrendous throwback uniforms that are so bad I can't help but fall in love with them. On a similar vein, I really like a lot of the team's throwbacks. Earlier this year, the Indians and Royals did a throwback game. I think it was back to their Negro League teams in the 1930s, and they were really, really cool uniforms. And the Rays throwbacks, I'm a huge fan of. So going away from sort of the bog standard uniforms into the like throwback special edition uniforms, there's a few I've got my eye on. Logo wise, I think someone mentioned the Brewers like glove logo on Twitter. I'm a big fan of that one. Begrudgingly, I've got to admit the Red Sox have quite a nice logo too. For me, like, I don't think the Rockies have a very good uniform or logo. They're a bit bog standard, which kind of explains why no one's ever heard of them or cares about them. So even as a fan of the team, I can't really back them up on either the uniform or the logo, unfortunately.
I agree. I think that the Rockies are a travesty because they managed to ruin purple, the colour of royalty.
Hashtag Purple Monday.
Fun and interesting with it. The Bourbon dynasty of sort of mid 17th century France, what they're doing over in Colombia. The Marlins, though, are just an absolute disaster. They are by quite some distance my least favourite. And you've got it, which again is going to come as no surprise. It's of course the Milwaukee Brewers Friday uniform, baseball glove logo, pinstripes, and all that lovely stuff. Right, so that's it. Lots of questions and a long show this week. So thanks, guys, for joining us and sticking with us through all of that. Just before we go, where can people find both of you on Twitter? So we'll start with you, Nick, as the guest.
Yeah, Nick Miller, at Nick Miller 79. It's a reference to Nottingham Forest, not my actual age, as most people assume it is.
And yeah, they can find all your writing in The Guardian, at Set Pieces and at ESPN and all that posted up there.
Loads of places, anywhere that will pay me within reason.
And Ben's actually died. No, he's there. That's all right.
I'm here, just about. You can find me at UK Baseball Blog on Twitter. I am going to be updating top five guests of the week at some point. I've been really bad at that. It's like a month behind now. But yeah, that will be on batflipsandnerds.com as soon as I get my arse in gear. I'd be out of line if I didn't get into my boss's good books and say, go and follow at MLB_UK too, because that's where I produce the real good stuff.
Yeah, they're really good gifts get rolled out on there. We just get the dregs. And you can follow me if you can find me and you want to. Good luck. Well done. I did mention at the top of the show that I would give details to our Manchester meetup, which I will. And well done and kudos to you if you stayed this long and didn't just look them up on Twitter. So that is going to be on the 13th of August. And it's going to take place at the Pie and Ale Bar. It's called Pie and Ale. That is literally what it's called. And it's also what it sells, which is on Lever Street in the Northern Quarter. We'll be hosting that with Gridiron and Gravy, the rather fantastically named Northern NFL meetup group. There'll be drinks and food deals on there. The pies are made by Manchester's The Bakery, which is spelt with an I at the end. I don't really understand what that means, but they're huge and they are absolutely awesome. So get yourself along there. Hopefully we'll get to meet some more listeners as we did at our really fun event down in London. So that's all we've got time for. Thanks to Nick.
Thanks, John.
And thanks to Ben. And we'll speak to you again soon.